Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is A Pilgrimage to Occupied Palestine, featuring Jack Gilroy of Veterans for Peace, interviewing Marianne Grady Flores of Ithaca Catholic Workers in Ithaca, New York on February 10, 2025. Jack and Marianne have both been active in the peace and justice movement for decades, and both have served multiple prison terms for various acts of civil resistance. Marianne recently returned from a week-long pilgrimage to occupied Palestine, a pilgrimage sponsored by Sabeel, an organization which, according to its website, strives to develop a spirituality based on love, justice, peace, nonviolence, liberation, and reconciliation for the different national and faith communities. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station.
Marianne, recently you've visited Palestine. Why did you go and who did you go with?
Thank you, Jack, for interviewing me today. I went with 10 people. We were invited to go with a community called Sabeel. And Sabeel is an incredible Christian community that is based out of Jerusalem, but it's not exclusive of Jerusalem. And these people were the ones that founded the Palestinian liberation theology. And Naeem Atik, whose book I have right here on Palestinian liberation theology, is somebody that I am on a Zoom with every Thursday at 11 Eastern time. But we have people from all over the world that participate in this Zoom call, people who've been to Palestine through the invitation of Sabeel, which means in Arabic, it means the way. So the invitation was made by that community. I've known many other people, Christians, but also non-Christians, internationals, interfaith people. We've had rabbis, we've had Jewish Voice for Peace members, Vets for Peace have gone. All kinds of folks have gone to be with Palestinians on the ground. As we saw this whole 15 months of absolute horrible genocide, we basically are needed. We Americans are needed on the ground there. Number one, to be a witness, but also our presence is a protection to Palestinians at times, not always, but at times. So we went with an Advent delegation. Because we went in December, that was the theme of this one. But Sabeel has been running delegations for the last year with a delegation every month. In November, they had 50 people go, and they did things like visit the Eretz crossing or near it, where, you know, when you go to Niagara Falls, you see those big, I don't know what you call them, but you can put your eyes through it and look at the falls more closely, or any amusement park. Anyway, they have this thing set up for the times when the bombing of Gaza was happening, so that Israeli children in school buses would come and start cheering on the bombing of Gaza.
Looking at it through the telescope.
Through these, I don't know what you call them, but you know what I'm talking about. And you look at
mountains. Basically, it's a telescope.
Yeah. It's so disheartening. It's horrible. So
before we even move on, people are interested in Sabeel, can they just Google that?
Sabeel, it's Sabeel.org. And they are located in East Jerusalem, which is the Palestinian area. In Shulfat is the name of the neighborhood that they're in. As I was getting ready for this interview, I was reminded that our challenge here in the United States is to challenge this very sick thinking of the Christian Zionists. Christians in the United States are hoping to be a part of the rapture once all Jews flood Israel, flood what I call occupied Palestine. So it's not just AIPAC having influence. It's people like Reverend Hagee and Huckabee and all of these folks that are in huge influential positions within the evangelical churches in the United States that have twisted the message of the gospel. And they've created this exclusive message versus the inclusive message that Jesus taught us, which was that you take care of the stranger, welcome the stranger as if they are angels of God, that we take care of the poor, we do, you know, the work of the Good Samaritan, and we sacrifice ourselves for the other. That's how we gain our redemption, in my understanding. So I flew in through Jordan into Amman, and my delegation met in a little city called Madaba, which is the city of mosaics. And I have to tell you, Jack, I was so grateful to be able to go in there because I, for the first time in my narrow American thinking or understanding of the Middle East, my eyes were open to a wider scale. Even though I had been in Palestine, this was my third time, I went to go visit these holy places in Madaba, where the Roman Empire had their beautiful columns. There were mosaics, like one of the best maps of the Middle East in the floor of one of the churches. We went to the church of St. John the Baptist. So I saw Christians holding on to their faith for 2,000 years from that area. Jesus walked to the Jordan River, which was right near where we entered. We did enter by crossing over the Jordan River to get into, like I said, occupied Palestine. The Israelis are controlling the checkpoint there. So it opened my eyes and it gave me an expansive look of the faith that has been held for 2,000 years before Islam came into being. We have the Abrahamic beliefs that converge, and people who have lived in the Holy Land, and I say that in an expansive way, into Jordan, into Lebanon, there are sites where the Christian apostles went, and we need to be aware that because of the oppression of the occupation of Palestine by Israel, more and more Christians have had to flee. I mean, the people that we met were saying this. There's only 2% Christians. So when we went in, we were invited to come and meet the living stones, not the dead stones, not just the antiquity of, oh, there's the Church of the Nativity where Jesus was born. Yes, we did go to visit that place, but we met the people that are keeping the faith alive that Jesus taught us. People like the evangelical Lutheran pastor, Reverend Munther Isaac, or Munther Isaac, if we say it in English, who for two Christmases in a row placed the baby Jesus, the little doll, within the church. I have photos. I sat next to this baby Jesus in the rubble, where the baby was lying on broken cinder blocks, as has happened in Gaza. The one thing I wanted to also mention, which just blew my mind, when we think about this genocide, and I will tell you about the first person that we met when we entered, but when I think about this genocide, it has affected and it has effectively caused ecocide as well as the killing of people and scholasticide. And I don't know what you call it when you have medical institutions totally destroyed, like all of the hospitals. I think there was 32, I'm sorry, I don't remember the numbers, but astronomical numbers of universities that have been destroyed in Gaza. What I witnessed when I was still in Jordan and I went to visit Mount Nebo, which is where apparently Moses was shown the promised land from this high point, this mountain. When I got to look over the valley where Moses was never allowed to enter, he was told, you can see it, but you can't go in. I was shocked. I saw a lot of desert area, but I saw lush areas as well. But the thing that struck me the most was this huge band of brown haze. And I realized that is the pollution from the bombing of Gaza. Gaza is only 25 miles long. It's just over half of the size of Lake Cayuga. Lake Cayuga is 2 miles wide in most of it, maybe a little wider. So Gaza is as if you were living in the lake with 2 million people, 2.2 million people. But we know now from the reports from the Lancet Medical Journal, one of the most prestigious medical journals in the world, They have estimated that there are at least, well, the official numbers and the Gaza Health Ministry never wrote anybody's name down unless they could actually identify and see and touch the body. So all the people that were in the rubble are now, just as people return, they're now finding more bodies, and people are trying to identify their son, the skull of their son that was left behind in the home. But they say it's about 47,000 that were officially counted, but there are thousands more. So at least 100,000, yeah.
200,000.
Maybe not.
The Lancet said 186,000.
But then they renewed their figures and they said at least 40% higher. So I don't know what to believe. Back in January, I think of 2024, they guesstimated that it was about 186,000, knowing that more would be killed and more would be found. Yeah.
Could you tell us a bit about your work with the people themselves, and what was their emotion? What was their thinking? What is their attitude at this particular time, Palestinian people?
It was amazing. The delegation that I was with was made up of, we had some Methodist pastors, we had some other people that were non-clergy, and some peripheral Christians among us. The thing that I was struck by was that the people we were introduced to were mostly Christians. That was the focus of that particular delegation, being that it was an Advent delegation. And what we found was that there was hope, and then less so, and then hope, and then less so. So it was a curve in terms of their message to us. And what I was very struck by was the deep, deep faith. Let me just read one thing real quickly. The Al-Makrur Valley is located in Bet Jala, which is northwest Bethlehem. And in terms of Palestine, it's renowned for its historic agricultural terraces, rich biodiversity, and cultural significance. And the valley is an integral part of UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's actually quite beautiful. So they call it Palestine, the land of olives and vines, cultural landscape of southern Jerusalem, Batir. So the Al-Makrur cultural and agricultural heritage reflects ancient farming practices and sustains the livelihood of local communities throughout the cultivation of apricots, figs, grapes, olives. I had no idea, because I'd been there before and I didn't focus on the agricultural aspects, but this was the Fertile Crescent. I mean, Jaffa is known for the most sweet oranges. When I ate the oranges in the morning, I was amazed, and I took pictures because they were so succulent, unlike what we have here.
What other differences did you see there, Mary Ann, from your previous trips? What takeaway did you have? What struck you as a difference?
The push to get rid of Palestinians by Israel is on steroids right now. So, for example, I wanted to see some of the people that I've known to go visit or have them come to us. We were on a very, very full schedule, very tight schedule. But because we had to travel on Palestinian roads and there were checkpoints that were closed, gates that were closed that we couldn't pass, we'd have to turn around and go all the way around a whole nother lengthy way to get to whoever we were visiting.
So security then is even greater than your previous times.
It's greater. And for example, one of the people that I knew from Nil'ing, which is another village in the north near Bil'ain, I may not be pronouncing this exactly accurate, but my friend Bassem Tamimi was taken in to jail on October 7th, along with many other thousands of people were picked up on that day, and many more since then. There have been over 13,000 prisoners, many of them held on administrative detention, which means you're in a holding pattern with no charges. You don't know why you're in there. So Bassem has been to my home. He came to my grandson's elementary school to speak to the third graders. He's a man of complete nonviolence. He's a steadfast advocate of nonviolence. His daughter, Ahed Tamimi, was imprisoned after an Israeli soldier came in and shot her cousin in the head, and her cousin is missing part of his skull as a result of that. And the same soldier came back to the house the next day to come in their yard, and she went up to him and slapped him in the face. That was the worst of the violence. That's as far as they go. But she was taken in and put in prison for, like, I think 8 or 10 months. I can't remember the sentence exactly. But she was incredible, and her story flashed around the globe. Everybody knew of Ahed Tamimi. And you can look her up on YouTube. She's been interviewed many times. So I wanted to see Bassem. But you know what? He was so tortured. My friend Omar said he's a broken man. He won't talk to anybody. He's afraid. And this is the same story over and over again with many people. We met with a young woman named Layan Nasir, who was from Birzeit University. She was taken out of her house in the middle of the night, 24 years old. She used to lead nature walks from the university. They held her in this prison. She said it was horrible. 23 hours of lockdown. They'd only get 1 hour to walk outside, and shackled, all shackled. When we saw her, she was quite thin, and she told us about the diet. She said Ben Gavir, who was one of the ministers of the Knesset, very close with Netanyahu, he came into the prison and saw that they were getting one ladle of soup, broth, and one ladle of rice. That's what they had every day. And he told the prison guards and everything, that's too much for them. The Israelis' hostages are not getting that good stuff, so let's give them less. And meanwhile, I'm looking at the YouTubes and the Instagram photos and the Facebook stuff of prisoners that are coming out. Some of them are being released in this prisoner exchange, and there have been rapes of men and women by dogs, by metal cattle prods, hot iron rods, just indescribable, and beatings nonstop. I saw just last night a young man who looked fantastic and healthy when he was younger, getting out of the prison. His jaws had been broken. Not only was he sunken from not eating, but he was beaten in the face so much that his face was broken. People have been burned with hot water, water poured on them. Just horrible stuff.
So, sort of Nazi-like.
Absolutely. It's torture. And this is all happening in the Israeli-run prisons in Israel. And I think some of the prisons may even be in the West Bank. But I think most of them are in the Israeli territory. And get this, Jack. These prisoners cannot be visited by their family members because they don't have the ID card to pass through into Israel proper. I mean, the stolen Israel proper. So what is happening right now, the Gazification of the West Bank has begun from the north, and it's coming down south. They're attacking Jenin. They've had bulldozers go in and rip up the streets. So the water system has been broken. The electrical, the sewage systems have been broken. And in the refugee camp of Jenin, they forced over 2,000 families. I don't know how many people altogether, but 2,000 families were forced out of that refugee camp because that has been a stronghold of resistance, much like Gaza, to this occupation and to the brutality of the Israeli military occupation.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is A Pilgrimage to Occupied Palestine, featuring Jack Gilroy of Veterans for Peace, interviewing Mary Ann Grady Flores of Ithaca Catholic Workers in Ithaca, New York, on February 10th, 2025.
You've already mentioned some of the Palestinian people that you met that just stays in your mind. Anyone else that you can think of that you'd want to tell us about?
Yes. There was a man named Osama. And when I mentioned to Osama that I was good friends with Diane Rowe, who had introduced me to Sabeel back in 2008, he was over the moon. hearing about Diane. Diane is an artist, and she invited me to be a part of the Christian Peacemaker teams back then. That team of people have now changed their name to Community Peacemaker teams. And like I said, we internationals have been invited to go in and accompany and witness alongside of Palestinians. We Christian Peacemaker teams did not go there to proselytize our faith. As a matter of fact, I personally was blown away at the faith of our Muslim sisters and brothers, given the most endearing hospitality, the kindness of the community. One time I was there living for 5 months, or almost 5 months, and I twisted my ankle and I ended up on crutches. And I was amazed where people would walk across a plaza to come over to me and say, Salamtek, which means peace be upon you, but it connotates, may you be healed quickly. When I'd get on a bus, and this was without the crutches, I know I am getting old now, but the kids would jump up to give me a seat. That would never happen in our Western culture, you know? So when I went into this organization called WEAM, I'll just read this little blip for you. It's a grassroots organization based in Bethlehem since 1994, and WEAM is the Palestinian civil society organization that aims to improve the quality of relationships and promote peace, justice, and a culture of acceptance and reconciliation in the community. So they run workshops on how to do conflict resolution. Men, women, kids, they run summer camps, and we got to sit down and be fed by them. And then they also run a women's embroidery workshop, and then they sell some of their things. But they are living right under the shadow of the wall in Bethlehem, and they continue to be steadfast and committed to nonviolence. That's what puts me in awe.
It must be difficult with the settlers, who are very often violent,
yes,
to be nonviolent.
Yes. And that's one of the things that Alice Kasia, who was from Al-Makrur, told us. She is a Christian herself. And she explained that in her experience, where the settlers had been coming in and sitting in her home, trying to take over her land, she has the paperwork that it is her family's land. She said she was coming to her property, traveling in from Jerusalem, and one of the settlers reached in and was choking her while she's sitting in her own car. And then when she called the police and they came 45 minutes later, they arrested her instead of the settler. And yet she has visions of Christ that speaks to her and said, you're not alone. Don't be afraid. I am with you. And this is another key thing I wanted to say, is that I did go in fearful. I was afraid of the authorities at the checkpoints, at the ones where you enter and leave. When I was on the ground, when I was with my Palestinian hosts and went to meet the different community members, whether they be Muslim or Christian, I did not have any fear being among them. It was the Israelis that I was afraid of. And I realized that I was not paying attention to the words of the angel Gabriel, whose message was to Mary, who was about to give birth under occupation of the Roman Empire and the minions of the Jewish state, like King Herod, that Gabriel came not just to Mary, but he also came to Joseph, and he also came to the three kings. And each time he said, don't be afraid. And that's what I feel like those Palestinian brothers and sisters are holding in their hearts. They are living that. And I've gained courage from them. They really lifted my spirits and reminded me. I have another funny story to tell you. So our friend, very, very funny guy, the guy has the best sense of humor. So he kept telling us, go home and make America great again, for one. And the other thing he said, he says, I went to a meeting and they asked me to take all these leaflets for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which if you listeners want to know, that means boycotting products that are made in the Israeli settlements, which is stolen land, and then divesting university funds, pension funds, teachers' union pensions, all kinds of ways that you had no idea your money was being used to prop up this occupation, this ethnic cleansing state. That's what Israel was based on in 1948. It was 750,000 people were forced out of their villages and out of their lands in order to accommodate the Jewish immigrants arriving after World War II.
The Nakba.
Yes, the Palestinians call that the Nakba, which means in Arabic, it means the catastrophe. Ironically, the Israelis call it Independence Day. But I wanted to say the message that I got from different Palestinians was that they refuse to be enemies with Israelis. They refuse to be changed within themselves. They want to hold on to their own humanity by saying, I'm not going to hate you. I'm not going to fight you. I'm going to love you. That was part of Christ's message. Love your enemies. And that is the hardest thing on the planet, I think, to do. So back to, he goes to this meeting and they tell him, oh, can you carry these flyers from one city to another? He says, oh yeah, sure, put it in my bag. So they were like, you're going to do this? Yeah. So he gets to the checkpoint and this colonel of the military says, open your bags, you know. And he says, what's all this? He goes, well, I was proving a point. This is a democracy. And the guy goes, oh yeah, you're right. He closed the bag and he let go.
Wow.
And that's the kind of courage that I was encountering all over the place, but courage with humor. Mm-hmm. And it was mind-blowing.
What did they say about the two-state policy?
We didn't hear that then, but I do believe at this point that if you look at the more recent map, and I don't remember the title of it, but the map shows four historic different time periods of historic Palestine from before 48 and then
67.
Yeah, but I don't know whether those are the accurate years. But anyway, all of these maps show the eating away of the Palestinian territory. And every parcel of Palestinian land has been separated from the other. It's like the holes of a Swiss cheese. It's not contiguous at all. So that wall that was supposed to separate the West Bank from Israel, it doesn't do that. It carves into and surrounds villages like Qilqilia. It has the walls totally surrounding it, and there's only one opening where people have to come in and out. And that happens throughout the West Bank, carving off people's agricultural land from their homes and from family members that have been forced to stay on one side or the other. And so two-state solution to me is not a solution at all. It's got to come down to, and this is going to take an awful lot of work, I think it needs to be a one-state solution. And this is what I've heard from Palestinians. It needs to be a society run under democratic principles. This is what our U.S. government says that it's exporting to many different nations, supposedly. I think more they're exporting their need for extraction of minerals and stuff, minerals and gas and oil and so on around the world, and also wanting positions of power, military power and points of power throughout the world. But Israel wants the whole shebang. They brought in front of the UN a map. Netanyahu brought a map of the greater Israel. And I've heard people, and I also have a neighbor that has the document from 1950. She was going through her deceased husband's papers, and he used to be an ultra-Zionist. And then little by little, she shared with him how that thinking is all messed up, that that's not true Jewish values. So what it shows is that they want the Sinai. They want all of Palestine proper. They want Lebanon. They want all of Syria. They want Jordan. And they want to go from the river to the sea. Their meaning of the river is the Euphrates River, which goes into Iraq. So they want the chunk of the western, southwestern part of Iraq. And then they will lop off the top of Saudi Arabia. This is their thinking. And if you look at what's going on since the 3,000 pagers blew up in Lebanon, what are they doing in Lebanon? They're moving forward and they're bombing in Syria. They've been bombing all along. We just don't hear about it in our news. Right now, the Israelis and the Lebanese, Hezbollah, were supposed to have a truce, a ceasefire. Israel has violated that ceasefire. They've not removed their troops back to the Israeli border. And I think it's just a continuation of their land grab. That's basically it.
Since you've studied this so well over the years, Marianne, and you've been there several times, and you've met so many Palestinian people, what do you think their response is to President Trump saying that they should be moved to places like Egypt and Lebanon?
I heard some very funny responses, again, going back to the humor. Let's take the Israelis and put them in Alaska. It's outrageous.
Yeah.
Palestine is for Palestinians. It's not for settlers coming in from Brooklyn and Russia and elsewhere, Uzbekistan, or even Ukraine. There's a lot of Israelis that are originally refugees from Ukraine. They're outraged. They're baffled. The whole world is shocked by this. So I think, you know, we need to help hold our officials and Trump accountable, the Musk-Trump team. And I honestly believe that we've got a lot of work to do. We've got a lot of work to do in terms of educating our people, but we also need to get in the streets. I was watching this morning millions of people that are marching in all the countries, and we have some marches, but not enough, because we are in the belly of the beast. This is where the decision-making is. This is where the armaments is coming from that actually supports and defends the whole ecocide and the genocide and the whole bit. Our mechanisms, our people in power, our armaments makes all of this move forward. The other thing that I saw was a little meme saying, some guy who was for Trump saying, well, we need to get rid of USAID. We need to let there be no more foreign aid and let the chips drop where they may. And then someone took that and they said, do you mean Israel too? Yeah. I was like, okay.
This is why we mentioned previously about AIPAC, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee that has bought out Congress. Chris Hedges mentions this as well, that it's probably one of the greatest swindles in history. $56 million is pretty much chump change, a huge amount of money that it is, but that's what they paid last year to buy out the United States senators and members of the House of Representatives.
Right.
So it very often, as not only Chris Hedges, but other analysts will say, Israel has become the tail that wags the American dog.
Yes.
AIPAC is at the very focus there. Do they know about AIPAC? Do the people know the political situation involved?
The Palestinians?
Palestinians. Yeah,
absolutely. Yes, they don't. They know. And that's another reason why they invite us to go there, be on the ground, see the facts, and then go back to our congresspeople and yell bloody hell, you know, to say that this is unacceptable. And the other key thing, as was said in a meeting recently in Ithaca, is that we need to organize ourselves on local levels to elect appropriate people that are not beholden to these lobbyists, AIPAC and such.
You're right on there, because your congressman,
yeah,
and mine, Josh Riley, he was elected because we believed that he would move away from the previous Republican. He was one of the freshman Democrats who voted with the Republicans and the others to protect the war criminal Netanyahu.
Right.
So that's not a very good start. So I guess we all have, don't we?
We have a lot of work to do on the ground right here in our own local communities, yeah.
You've been involved considerably with Cornell students.
Yes.
What about the Free Palestine movement at Cornell?
Well, the students have really educated me to understanding how deeply involved and complicit all of the educational institutions are throughout the country. They've peeled back the mask and exposed how many investments are actually supporting the war effort, the genocidal effort, and the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And students did an action that was so, I would call it heroic, but they went into the Statler Hotel, where in the ballroom, a jobs fair was being held. And 100 students came with pots and pans, and they marched into the building, they went upstairs, and they broke up the jobs fair. And oh my God, that's exactly the point of machinations where the university is providing for these merchants of death. They're providing the leadership, they're providing research and development by taking and recruiting these students. So to break that up was great. Boeing and L3Harris were the two weapons makers that were holding this jobs fair and doing the recruitment of students. So it's an unholy alliance that's going on. It's also amazing to understand that, for example, the engineering school, they fund the school, number one. So the students themselves, some of them are getting scholarships, and so they feel beholden to these corporations, these weapons makers that are making a killing off of killing. That's terrible. For example, you know, we have this whole board of trustees. Actually, the former head of the board of trustees at Cornell just resigned. And apparently he had tons of money invested in the, as we would call it, the merchants of death, the weapons makers. And I think it was, I'd have to go back to look at the Cornell Sun, who did some deep investigation and learned that he had his hands bloody in this thing. And here he is leading the pack of the Board of Trustees. So I was there when the Board of Trustees were meeting in the Johnson School of Management, and I saw that Anna Kellis, our assembly representative from Ithaca, was in on that meeting. And I approached her afterwards. I've known her since she was young. I mean, this Ithaca is a tiny town. Everybody knows everybody. And I've been here now almost 30 years in Ithaca. I've come back. My family's been here 50 years, so we know a lot of people. And I wonder who is in the room that could challenge this narrative that the Board of Trustees can continue with that path. Apparently, a new woman is coming in. I don't know her name yet, but she also has her hands in oil and gas, as well as some alternative energy businesses. But, you know, people that are on Board of Trustees boards usually are coming in with buckets of money. And so they are the influencers. And many of them are Zionists, and not necessarily Jewish Zionists, but they're Zionists supporting the state of Israel. And as a result, the repression of the students has been outrageous, where one student that I know has had to leave. He has lost 3 years of funding for his research. He's a PhD student for his research in studying the mycelium, the relationship between trees and the mycelium in the soil. Other students have their visas being threatened. And now that the executive order came out just last week, people feel like they have to go in hiding. And this is horrible. I mean, we just had
students going into hiding.
Yeah, because they're afraid that ICE is coming along and will pick up students. You know, as Trump threatened, he said anybody who has supported the protests for Gaza or for Palestine will be deported. That has a huge chilling effect. So just to give an example, there was a Palestinian dinner hosted at Cornell University on campus, and I helped with the serving of it, the food and all. And I noticed there were quite a number of people that I knew, students, that were missing in the room because they're afraid to come out.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is A Pilgrimage to Occupied Palestine, featuring Jack Gilroy of Veterans for Peace, interviewing Marianne Grady Flores of Ithaca Catholic Workers in Ithaca, New York, on February 10th, 2025.
You might note as well, everyone can go on to veteransforpeace.org, and the very first thing that will pop up is a black fist and a pledge to not interview with the arms makers.
Yeah.
And that is something that if students can get that pushed around the country, don't you think that might be of some
Absolutely.
Use?
Yes, and I did talk to students about that just yesterday.
Could you explain one thing that really amazes a lot of people? American people in general look upon Israelis as the good guys and Palestinians as bad people. Why is that?
Well, it has everything to do with our media. It has to do with specifically what I now understand, legacy media, like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, all of those have never given space for the Palestinians to say their side of the story. And so the Palestinians' narrative has been pushed out of the press that we read. And so we've been brainwashed, basically. I didn't know about Palestine, not seriously, not before, let's say, 2000, just 24 years ago. I grew up in the Bronx. I grew up among my beloved Jewish neighbors. Some of them had the numbers on their arms from Auschwitz and other camps. But I never met Palestinians. I now know where there are pockets of Palestinian communities throughout the United States, and I'm loving those communities. They're warm and they have a rich, rich culture. And the other thing I'm learning is that Palestinians are some of the most educated people in the world. They've not had their own state, and so they held on to education as one of the highest priorities. So there was a young man, and I need to look up his name. He had three PhDs. He introduced us to the history of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We got to go in there. He was able to tell us, and he showed us the corner within the mosque where the women were killed. He was there that day. He filmed it. And he showed us on his phone the murder of these women while they were praying. It is so sick. So this holy site, it's the second most holy site in the world for Muslims. It's a place where the idea is that the temple would be rebuilt right on the site of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And the Christian Zionists are buying into this narrative that this is the way it has to happen in order for us to have our redemption and our rapture to go to heaven. So 3/4 of the Jews would be killed. What a crazy alliance. The whole thing is really wacky and it doesn't make sense.
And a Christian Zionist has been appointed to be the ambassador to Israel from the United States.
Huckabee. Right? Huckabee. Mike Huckabee, one of the worst. He says there is no such thing as Palestinians. There is no such thing as Palestine. I mean, my Jewish neighbor, Sarah Pines, has her old passport from when she's 90 now, or maybe older than 90. She has her Palestinian passport because that's where she was born. And by the way, Jews, Muslims, and Christians live together, side by side. My friend Isa Amro, his father, not his grandfather, but his father, co-owned a shop in Hebron, or El Halil, as they say it. It's where I lived, right on Shuhada Street. So his father would go to the mosque on Friday, and the Jewish fellow would run the shop on Friday. And then on Saturday, for Shabbat and to go to temple, the Jewish guy would take the day off on Saturday. So there was a mutual love and respect of one another. And that is very much central to the tenets of the Muslim faith and the original Jewish faith and the Christian faith.
Sure. And isn't it the truth that the Palestinian people are Semitic people?
Yes.
And yet when they say anti-Semitic, it's supposed to be just
only for
Israel.
Yeah. So there's a wonderful, wonderful Jewish community right in Brooklyn and elsewhere, that where the keffiyeh stole, the Palestine stole, and say, our Torah has been stolen by the Zionists. This is not what the Torah teaches. We were never supposed to have a state. And if you think about it, our rejecting of Jews when those boats were leaving Europe and landed on our shores. And we said, oh, no, only 125,000 or 120,000 would be received into our, that is racist. And so this whole thing that, oh, we have to send them to Israel or, you know, use this stolen land to place these people. There's another take on all this. I'm Irish on both sides of the family. We go back, our families go back to the 10th century. And we have suffered, we Irish people have suffered under British colonialism, where colonialism was refined for 800 years. And especially if you look at the map of Ireland, it's like a rectangle top to bottom. If you cut it into four parts, the top right-hand corner is the province of Ulster. We Irish call it the North of Ireland, not Northern Ireland. The British named it Northern Ireland, and they have, to this day, still control that area, which is highest economic, you know, they'd have shipbuilding up there and making of lace and other things. So the British, the colonels in the military were the worst in Ulster. And what they did when the British Mandate was happening down in, when the Ottoman Empire broke up, I learned this from Richard Lloyd Barrett, who was with an Irish party called People Over Profit Party in Ireland. And he said that the British took their worst torturers and placed them into Jerusalem and Palestine. And the British mayor of Jerusalem said, we are trying to create a little loyal Jewish Ulster in the Sea of Arabism. And they wanted to control. It's a point of control. That's what Israel is for the Western powers. One other thing that I need to mention is that if you look at the coastline, the Mediterranean coastline of occupied Palestine, you have at the bottom of it, bumped up against the Sinai Desert and Egypt, Egyptian border, is the little strip of Gaza. It's only 25 miles long, like I said at the beginning, and it's 5 miles in the Rafah area, 5 miles wide, and then it narrows to 2 miles. So it's not a big area at all. But if you take that coastline and think of that area of Gaza as being the crust of a slice of pizza, and then the slice of pizza goes out into the Mediterranean, within that area, there are billions of cubic meters of gas that the Israelis want their hands on.
Not only the Israelis, but apparently the United States now under Trump.
Yeah, I mean, Trump just said, we're gonna move in. We're gonna clear the whole place out, get rid of the 2 million Gazans living there, Palestinians. No, it's not to be. So that gas was discovered in 1999 into 2000. The Palestinian Authority in Ramallah gave the contract to British Oil and Gas to go and do the discovery of it, and they found it. So Chevron has actually been drilling there for a long time. And when October 7th happened, which in my view and my tons of research on this, and I've watched forensic documentaries on the happenings of the day, I believe it was allowed to happen for many reasons, including the Egyptians' head of security calling Netanyahu and saying, this is going to happen tomorrow. And they ignored it. They took 80% of the soldiers off of that security fence, the Gaza security fence, and they sent them up north to Lebanon. So there was nobody home to watch the fence. And I heard a retired general who was in charge of that fence, and he said, no way could that have happened without it being allowed to happen. So I understand from Jeremy Scahill and from another woman who's on the Zoom call with Sabeel, the original purpose of the break was to gather up people that could be held in exchange for the 13,000 Palestinians that are being held in the prisons, and some of them for decades. That was the original purpose. And when Palestinians in Gaza saw that the fence was open, they just jumped on scooters, they jumped into a car, and they ran into, by the way, they ran into the villages that used to be their parents' and grandparents' homes And sometimes people were killed, and sometimes people were taken. So Hamas actually lost control of what was going on that day. They did not know even where people were taken to within Gaza. So it turned out to be a mess. But the original purpose was to have an exchange, just like when Shalit Gilat, I think is the name of the Israeli prisoner, was taken years ago and he was held for 5 years. And in exchange for that one soldier, the Israelis had to give up like 1,000 prisoners or hostages. I mean, we can use that word interchangeably. I don't think any hostage taking is a good thing. I don't condone the violence on either side because I am a proponent of nonviolence, but I don't have the right to make judgment on other people's struggles, especially when they have lived under this terrible occupation for so long and they have tried nonviolent tactics. For example, they had a whole campaign called the Right of Return where they marched up to the fence. They couldn't get through, but it was a nonviolent effort to come towards the fence. And what did the Israelis do? They had snipers that would go and aim at the knees of the young people and paralyze them, just take them out at the knees. They shot at medics and paramedics and ambulance drivers, which they did the whole time in Gaza also. I do want to go back and I want to highlight this one woman, the first person we met when we arrived in Jerusalem at the Christmas hotel. We met a woman named Budur Hassan, who was the co-author of the Amnesty International Human Rights Report on the genocide. And she was interviewed on Democracy Now! By Amy Goodman on the day that I was traveling to the West Bank, to Jordan. She was interviewed, and she started by saying, "We are so sorry that it took so long. People want to know, well, why is this coming out now in December of 2024? Why is this happening now when this genocide has continued for so long?" She said, "We had to be exact. We had to make sure that we could prove the elements of the definition of genocide according to the Geneva Conventions and the parameters that the UN has set up years ago, you know, in 48, after the Holocaust and the genocide had happened to Jews in Europe." So Budur talked about how she did interviews with surgeons in the middle of surgery. She was getting testimony from people. She called multiple times to make sure that everything that was said was absolutely accurate. And she just interviewed all kinds of people, parents, children, and press people. And the title of the report is, "We Feel Like We Are Subhuman." And those are the words that were used by Gallant, Yoav Gallant, who was one of the military heads of Israel and others, who were announcing what they were going to do to Gaza ahead of time. And they've done it. So right now, we cannot relax. We can't think, oh, it's all over, because the actual healing and the restoration and just the mere maintenance of Palestinians' lives is at stake right now. Still to this day, the aid trucks are not being allowed in by the Israelis, even though that was a part of the ceasefire agreement.
Marianne, we've spoken an awful lot about what is happening in Palestine, the horror that the Israelis being anti-Semitic in attacking Semitic people. And then they are supposed to, of course, put the guilt feelings on these very people. How do we change that narrative that seems to be part of American life here, that the Israelis are the good guys and those Palestinians not so good?
I think it's going to have to happen. Just like the United Farm Workers Union sent farm workers to the cities around the country to tell their narrative person to person, we need to have more and more people meeting or hearing the stories of people on the ground. We're going to have to bypass the legacy media. are going to have to help bring the stories. And that's what you're doing today by interviewing me, by letting me share the stories of the people I met. And the Palestinians' message is, we refuse to be enemies. We're not going to go along with this thing of, like, you're the other. No. Just let me be free in my own country. We can live together. There's enough land for all of us. We can share this land, is the message that I was given to share with you, the listeners.
What do you suggest that people do in Christian churches throughout the United States?
Well, Sabeel, like I said earlier, they have had many, many different delegations go. And for example, on my delegation, I had a guy from Idaho, from Boise, who was the pastor at the Rocky Mountain Cathedral. And then there was another pastor from Georgia who teaches at Emory College. There was people from Atlanta, people from Virginia, people from Ithaca, people from New York City. So there are people that have already gone that can be invited to the churches to tell what they witnessed firsthand. That's a beginning point. The other thing is that people can go. But we definitely, definitely need to get the story out, you know, the person-to-person stories. I mean, there's so many people I met, I can't even mention them all today right here. It's too long. We were getting in the van at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning and going until 6 and 7 and so at night, going from place to place. Like I said, we went to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We went to the Tent of Nations. We went to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. We went to Church of the Nativity. But this was our Advent delegation, which was different from the next delegation. Every delegation had their own feel and theme and whatnot. But the other thing that people can do, the next time you go shopping, you can help Palestinians by boycotting certain brands. I just heard that in Turkey, Pizza Hut and KFC chicken franchises, they've had to shut down because everybody's boycotting them in Turkey. We need to be doing the same thing here. If you go to bds.org, boycottdivestmentandsanctions.org, there you'll see the list of the different brand names that you can boycott, like Sabra hummus, for example. And then there's Lay's potato chip. I don't understand all of the circuitous connections, but there are products that are made in the settlements, which are built on stolen Palestinian land in the West Bank. It's not in what is considered Israel proper. I don't consider it any of it proper. It needs to be one democratic state for all.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was A Pilgrimage to Occupied Palestine, featuring Jack Gilroy of Veterans for Peace, interviewing Marianne Grady Flores of Ithaca Catholic Workers in Ithaca, New York on February 10, 2025. Jack and Marianne have both been active in the peace and justice movement for decades, and both have served multiple prison terms for various acts of civil resistance. Marianne recently returned from a week-long pilgrimage to occupied Palestine, a pilgrimage sponsored by Sabeel, an organization which, according to its website, strives to develop a spirituality based on love, justice, peace, nonviolence, liberation, and reconciliation for the different national and faith communities. I'm Wilton Vaught, saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.